Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Jessica Pierce. Jessica is a bioethicist and writer. Her work focuses on human-animal relationships and the interconnections between ecosystems and health. She's written 10 books and has another coming out soon, written with Mark Beckoff, about how dogs might live in a world without humans. You can find Jessica's All Dogs Go to Heaven blog at Psychology Today. I'd love to know what you think of the episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write a review or give some stars on your listening platform? I want to thank Helen Ara, Earthling 2020, and Claudia Hirtenfelder, a previous guest, who've done just that. Helen says, it's a podcast to definitely share. Sometimes you find those poddies which you want to keep to yourself like a little treasure you don't want the rest of the world to have a piece of. This one, however, is a podcast everyone should be listening to. Sentientism means a better world for absolutely everyone, always with fascinating guests. Earthling 2020 says it's a great show, professional interviews on an important topic. Sentientism is an idea whose time has come. And Claudia says, so far I've listened to two episodes, but I can already tell I will be a regular visitor. Jamie is an excellent interviewer, I am blushing, and I appreciate he's trying to do long-form interviews that also allow for guests to really express their views. Thank you all, and to everyone who's given us a star rating too, which takes 5 seconds on any platform. Every rating, review, subscription, and share helps get our ideas about compassion and rationality into more ears and minds. We're well on our way to 8 billion, I'm sure. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks as ever for listening. Good morning, Jessica. How are you?
I am doing very well.
Good. Well, thank you so much for making the time to join this sentientist conversation. We've talked a little bit online, so it's great to have the chance to have a proper conversation with you. But as a reminder, this is a series of conversations about the two deepest philosophical questions, what's real and what matters. And this very simple pluralistic philosophy I'm trying to raise awareness of, sentientism, answers those questions in hopefully what is a common sense way. It says when it comes to thinking about what's real and what to believe, it suggests we should use evidence and reason and take a naturalistic approach. And when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name, that we should have compassion for, we should have moral consideration for all beings that are sentient, that are have the capacity to suffer or flourish or experience. Yes. But in these conversations, I'm talking to people who agree with that philosophy and disagree with both or either element of those. So it'll be fascinating to see where the conversation goes, particularly given your expertise and your background. But before we get into those two central questions, how would you best introduce yourself for people that don't already know of your work?
So I'm a bioethicist by training. For those who aren't familiar with that line of work, I'm trained in philosophy and religious studies, and particularly in ethics and in the intersection of ethics with the biomedical sciences. The old name for bioethicist was medical ethicist, but it's really the field has broadened out from simply working in a hospital setting, clinical setting. I did actually start out the first 10 years of my career in a clinical setting. I worked at a medical center and really dealt with I guess you could say traditional medical ethics issues, although I was untraditional in the sense that I was trying to get people in my field to think about the environmental components of healthcare. I mean, that healthcare is this sort of enormously impactful and in many ways wasteful and unsustainable system that damages human health at the same time trying to promote human health. Since 2008, I've really been focused on animals and animal ethics. And I see it very much within the field of bioethics still, but unlike my colleagues in bioethics, I'm not primarily thinking about animals in the research setting.
Yeah.
Although I think about that too, but I've mainly been thinking about companion animals and our relationships with companion animals. And what got me started on that was the experience of the last year of life of my dog, Odie. and the difficulty of being a caretaker for an aging and dying animal, and how the ethical issues are really every bit as complex as the ethical issues that we face in human end of life decision making, which is really the bread and butter of bioethics is death and dying and assisted suicide and euthanasia and
care and
palliative care and making decisions for people who cannot articulate their own wishes. And I'm like, the issues I'm dealing with my dog are just as difficult, and in some ways more difficult because people don't talk about them very much. That kind of got me, I shouldn't say into, but back into thinking about animals primarily as my daily professional life. And I have been since then. And again, mostly companion animals, although I've written about animals in all sorts of different realms of human-animal relationships, and it's never boring thinking about these issues. Just a species of mind that we inhabit in our relations with animals are so vast and complex and interesting. So,
it's a fascinating space and still widely neglected.
I think it could use a lot more work. Although a lot of people are thinking about it in very interesting ways, but the more it seems to me, from my experience, the more research and literature there is, the less we know.
And
that's a good trend.
I think it is. And I'm very much an amateur sort of reader of the academic work from the outside, so much of it will just go over my head. But I do get the sense that in recent years, there's been a real deepening and diversity of proper academic thought about non-humans and non-human ethics. It almost seems like there's a switch in people's minds, right? So most academics, most philosophers, most ethicists just have this default view that we'll come back to later, that humans are what matter, right? Humans are the raw material of ethics, and that's the end of the story. And as soon as that switch is flicked in people's minds and they start going, hold on, other minds exist, other beings are capable of suffering, surely that has moral salience, all of a sudden a whole new world of richness and complexity opens up. But I think we'll come back to that and explore that later on.
That sounds good.
So the first of the questions that I'm interested in asking, because this sentientism idea has two basic tenets, one naturalism and one, I guess, sentiocentrism. So it's the epistemology and then it's the ethics, if you like. And on the first of those questions, that question about what's real, I'm really interested in people's personal philosophical journeys as they've gone through their lives. So for some people, that's a story about whether they grew up in a religious or a spiritual household or more naturalistic, atheistic setting, and how they're thinking on that side of philosophy has shifted over time, if it has at all. So you can wind the clock back as early into your childhood as you feel comfortable, but it'd be fascinating to hear that story, partly because it obviously links into your academic work as well.
It's a cliche, but I grew up in a house, and particularly with a father who was very outdoorsy, in the sense, not of hunting and fishing, but of his, it goes actually very far back in my family roots, my grandparents and backwards, this tradition of hiking and backpacking and being in the woods. And we're all originally from California. So it was the Sierras, and particularly the Central Sierras, but also the Colorado Mountains. We have a family cabin that's been in our family for generations. It's in the middle of the woods in the Colorado forest. And so I grew up having a lot of nature experience, and that being really sort of my home, my spiritual home, I guess you could say. My parents were California hippies, and their approach to religion was to take my brother and I to as many different sort of houses of worship or forms of worship as we could find, as they could find. So we went to synagogues, and we went to Baptist churches, and we went to Buddhist temples, and all sorts of just exposure to a wide range of forms of belief. And and so the spirit within which I grew up was that there are kernels of truth in every tradition. And you also don't want to get stuck in one.
Yeah.
Because then you get a narrow focus and become excluding in your mind and your spirit of other possibilities.
Yeah.
So I studied religion as an undergraduate and as a master's student and as a PhD student. And it's funny, people say, how is it that somebody with a PhD in religion is an atheist? That's what happens when you study religion, is it turns you that way. Atheist isn't actually quite an accurate description, because I don't reject the theist traditions, but I also don't embrace them to the exclusion of other ways of thought. And I've been really deeply influenced by mystical traditions, Eastern philosophy, particularly Buddhism. And I think my attitude toward the natural world really comes from this kind of blending of traditions and a sense that I've had from a very young age that God, and in quotes here, but if there is some spiritual essence, it's in nature.
Yeah.
This is sort of broadly distributed. It does not belong to humans.
Yeah.
And it's not, nor is it up in the sky. Well, it's maybe up there too, but it's here. Heaven is a state of mind, a state of being.
Yeah.
There's a being in harmony or peace with your naturalistic surroundings. And that humans are not, getting to the point of sentientism, that humans are not the center of the world. They're not the center of the universe. They're not the center of God's attention, if there is a God. And that the way we tend to approach the world and as something to be exploited and used is really an offense to what's right and good, I guess, is one way to say it.
Well, thank you. And I quite like the definition of atheism that just says it's an absence of a belief in a deity. So it's not an explicit rejection of it. It's not saying, oh, I'm 100% sure there isn't. It's just saying, well, I don't see the evidence, so I don't hold that belief. I prefer that way of framing it, which for some people, they think that's, whether it's agnosticism or atheism, I'm not sure. Personally, for me, it's still quite an extreme version, because I think there's, you know, it's such an unfeasible hypothesis that my belief is almost zero, but it's still not zero. I remain open-minded. And I like the way you frame that conception of, I don't tend to use the word God to describe it in those terms, just because of this association it has with there being an entity that is all-powerful, that defines morality and so on. But that conception of the fact that we are all connected, that we are part of a extended universe, that in the Buddhist sense, there's a sort of impermanence about ourselves and there's a connection with everything, and that we should feel, even in a naturalistic way, a sort of reverence for that and a respect for it and an appreciation for it is something I think even someone with a very naturalistic worldview like me can completely identify with. And I think the feelings that gives us are often very similar to those sort of senses of awe and wonder and connectedness that someone who's more traditionally religious might feel. But I think it's more naturalistically grounded.
Yeah. And I would definitely put myself in that camp of naturalism. I find pantheism appealing. And I agree with you about the problematic nature of the term God. And I actually use it with a small g, not a big g, just to remain open to the idea that there is something beyond us. Because I think that's getting to the second part of the sentientism issue, the ethics. You can't really disentangle these very easily. I think the attitude toward the natural world of not thinking we know everything, not thinking we are, we tend to make ourselves godlike. Yeah. And scientists and the sort of the scientific framework, I think, falls into this trap of this is how it is.
Yeah.
We are all knowing. There are, of course, bits of knowledge that we don't have, but we know what those are and we'll fill them in eventually. And I think a sense of humility about the rest of the world is really important to, at least as I experience it, having a sense of respect and nonviolence and live and let live. We don't know what matters to other beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we need to just tread lightly and carefully and respectfully.
I think that's a really important point, because I take quite what might seem like quite a hard-edged materialist, mm-hmm. naturalistic yeah. worldview, a scientific worldview. But I think you're absolutely right that there's a danger, in the same way as I see there's a danger in supernatural yeah. or religious worldviews, that they can be dogmatic, that they
yeah.
you know, bring an end to thinking. We have the answer, yeah. it's written down, do not question, and yeah. Almost brings an end to progress. There is that similar risk in a scientific or a scientistic yeah. worldview as well. And the tone can sometimes come across as quite arrogant and closed-minded. You know, we have the evidence. Yeah. We have the logic, it's incontrovertible, it cannot be challenged. And whereas, of course, the real power of a scientific worldview or a naturalistic worldview, as you just said, is actually yeah. having humility at its heart. Is yeah. you know, our belief should be provisional, always open to new evidence. They should be probabilistic. We're never so yeah. confident that we close our minds
yeah.
and that we should be prudent about what we believe as well. But it's very easy to forget that. I think it's easy to forget that in a scientific way of yeah. thinking, as well as in a religious one.
And something I've been thinking about a lot, and I just mentioned, are you familiar with the work of John Gray?
Yes.
Okay. So I just read Straw Dogs not too long ago. Have you read Straw Dogs?
Yes.
And so it's something that I've come back to over and over throughout the years. And that is to really question the assumptions of progress that, and I think I've fallen into this trap myself in the work that I've done and trying to really push on the science of who animals are. And if once we understand that animals are sentient, thinking, feeling beings, then that'll solve all the problems that animals are facing, because we'll see that it's wrong to cause suffering to them. And I'm not sure that science is, or ethics, human moral thinking, progress or evolve in this upward
yeah.
getting better and better kind of curve. And science is not, 10 years ago, and I even said as much in our book, The Animals Agenda, that once, you know, it's absolutely incontrovertible that the more we learn about animals, the more we understand that they're thinking, emotion, suffering beings, and the taxonomic expanse of who is sentient and who has the capacity to suffer is really getting bigger and bigger. It used to just be primates, and then we could add dogs and cats and mammals, and now having to think about mollusks and fish and insects and even yeah. trees and plants as having awareness and feelings. But so many people who, like, they know the science and it doesn't matter. That's puzzling to me. And I wish it weren't the case, but I'm sure you've come across this a lot too. And when I was teaching animal ethics to students, you show a video of the horrors of a slaughterhouse, and nobody can deny that the cows in the video are suffering, that they're sentient, and the students are visibly distressed. And then you get to the discussion after the video, and they'll say, I really like steak.
Yeah.
Like, I got to keep eating my steak. That's weird, but it is also part of the human condition. I'm sure that you've come across that experience a lot.
I have.
We just have blinkers on. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you could draw a parallel to human ethics as well. After the Second World War, pretty much every country signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but we still have so far to go, right? Just recognizing the moral value of something, whether it's sentience or humanity, is not sufficient. Yeah. And progress towards actually making the world a better place is not by no means guaranteed. And I think, again, in the same way as there's a risk of a religious form of dogmatism and a naturalistic form of dogmatism, you can find something similar around this sort of human exceptionalism as well, in that there's a form of, you know, religious or supernatural way of thinking that sees humans as made in God's image, as somehow distinct and special. We have dominion and therefore rights to cause harm in our own needs. But there can be a naturalistic view of that as well, which says we're at the pinnacle of some sort of evolutionary tree. We have capabilities that are more distinctive, we're more intelligent, and therefore that gives us a right as humans to oppress others as well. And that's one of the things I find fascinating, is this link between whether the epistemology is religious or naturalistic. How does that flow through into a more compassionate ethics? Because for me, my journey away from a religious way of thinking was partly evidence and reason and just saying it doesn't make sense. And similar to you, I didn't do a PhD in religion, but as I read more about different religions and their history, it became much more obvious to me that these were human creations, often written in a self-serving way by men a couple of thousand years ago, and therefore not a great basis for facts. But there was also an ethical set of challenges there as well, which also made me think, hold on, this is explicitly sexist or homophobic or setting humans apart, or what's this caste discrimination system, or why would you treat apostates like that, or why would you tell your children you're going to burn in hell forever? It's like, well, okay, this even if there was evidence, I wouldn't like those ethics, right? These are not deities I want to follow or worship. So it was almost a mix of those two things that led me to a naturalistic stance. But some people are nervous about moving to a naturalistic stance because they're worried that moving away from something religious or supernatural means they'll be without foundation in their morals. And it would be interesting to understand your story there, because obviously you started out with, I guess you would never really have described yourself as religious, but you had a sort of broad, pluralistic, maybe somewhat sort of spiritual sense of connectedness. I guess you became a sort of, in a soft sense, an atheist as you studied. But I'm interested in how that links to your morality, what you thought was important, at what point, at what stage did you start to take non-humans seriously in an ethical context? Was that something that, again, happened very early? Or
it did. And it's a complex question.
Yeah, sorry, there's probably about four questions in there.
I know, I have 800 answers. So I think that my basic moral impulse is compassion.
Yeah.
And I think that that has remained the same. I have, you know, always felt that way, and that animals deserve our compassion and even other forms of life. I'm an avid rock climber, and so I have this sense of rocks having even a sense of meaning and value. And they're individuals in a way. Maybe that sounds really weird. I don't think it is, because I think they are living creatures in the sense of being, I mean, their life cycle is extraordinarily long, geologic. But if you go around, it's almost, I think we have this human impulse toward compassion and empathy. And then you go around, especially if you're an ethicist, and look for some way to explain or justify why you have those feelings.
You build the rationale afterwards.
I think that's how ethics works, by the way, that it really is a reflection of and a reflection upon our deep evolutionary impulses, some of which aren't so good and some of which, or I shouldn't say it like that, because that's suggesting that certain impulses that are totally natural, like aggression, are bad. And I don't think that at all. I think there may be impulses that we want to cultivate, the impulses toward compassion, sensitivity, and then impulses that we might not want to cultivate in ourselves. And I think that where science comes in an interesting way for me is, so I guess one way you could describe my moral philosophy is mindfulness.
Yeah.
Mindfulness emerging from compassion. But compassion without attention to the details can backfire or not really be effective. And thinking, for example, of our relationships with companion animals, with dogs, you could have endless compassion for your dog, but if you don't understand sort of the basics of dog behavior, you may really end up hurting your dog unintentionally by, for example, using training techniques that are psychologically damaging, or by not feeding the right food, or not recognizing signs of pain. You could think of all sorts of examples where being educated, scientific about your approach would improve your caretaking.
Yeah.
And make your compassion more grounded and mindful. And
So the compassion by itself isn't enough. It needs to be paired with an appreciation of the perspective of the other being you're engaging with.
Yes.
Otherwise your compassion might be misdirected or potentially even damaging. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that perspective shift is, I think that's centrally important, because in a way, the perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the good. I will never understand what it's really like to be Luna, but then I would never really understand what it's like to be you either. Yeah. Our understanding of the perspective of anybody else is always partial and incomplete and flawed. But at least if you can openly and honestly, and I guess this is another good place to be naturalistic, right? If you engage honestly with that reality to try and understand and develop your perspective, the better your understanding of their perspective, the more, you know, powerful and valuable your compassion can be.
Yeah. An example of where learning is useful. You know, when I was a child, I used to always try to save the worms off the sidewalk. When it rained, they would all, you know, come out of the grass and onto the sidewalk, and then it would get warm and the sidewalk would they'd be stranded there. And I'd put them back into the soggy grass. And I'm not sure that was the right thing to do because they drown.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was trying to help, but I didn't really understand worm behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was, in essence, killing all of the worms, trying to help them.
And obviously that's been the center of a lot of your work, and with Mark as well, is genuinely trying to understand the perspective of companion animals so that we can, you know, live in a better way with them. But that perspective shift is also interesting, because you talked about plants and trees and rocks and having a sort of reverence and appreciation for them as well. And in a way, sentientism doesn't specify what beings are sentient. It just says follow the science. I guess we'd have a slightly different perspective on that, because in a way, I don't think those types of entities actually have a perspective at all. So I don't think there's anything that it's like to be a rock or a tree or a plant. But having said that, I also don't think we can define a really perfect boundary either, because in a way, you and I are just doing information processing.
Yeah.
And there is information processing going on in a tree or a plant and a rock as well. And I think my personal default, and other sentientists disagree, because there are other sentientists who, like you, have a broader understand or appreciation of what sentience is. And I take a more traditional approach that says it's likely to be driven by a certain evolutionary process. Mm-hmm. That has particular impact on mobile animals, but probably not on plants. It has a certain information processing architectural requirement that we can see in ourselves and other animals that just doesn't seem to be present in rocks and plants and so on. So I guess I'd still draw that boundary somewhere between generally animals and other stuff and say, look, we have a perspective, we have sentience, we have the capacity to suffer, whereas those other things can be harmed and damaged, but they don't experience anything themselves. So I would draw the boundary there differently. But at the same time, I'm open-minded about where that boundary is, because it's probably fuzzy. But also, I'm quite comfortable with people extending their moral scope of consideration more broadly than sentient beings, as long as we don't ignore any of the beings that are obviously sentient. And I think this is one of the frustrations I have with the mainstream environmental law.
I think we probably basically agree. I would not limit the beings that have a perspective, because I think that is, we don't know who has a perspective. Yeah. And then you get into this kind of line drawing. Octopi have a perspective, but sponges don't have perspective. And we don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
But so I think one reason I like the word reverence for all life, with life not being confined to sentient beings necessarily, is that it allows us to have a feeling of awe, respect, appreciation for the existence of other creatures very unlike us, without having to specify exactly what their experiences are.
Yeah.
However, I would say if I had to choose between eating a plant and eating an animal, I would certainly choose eating a plant. Yeah. And I don't think it hurts the plant to eat it.
Yeah.
You can get into those kind of ad absurdum conversations, which people who are, you know, pursuing the carnivore agenda try to push you into.
Yeah.
And those are cul-de-sacs.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
I agree.
And I think they don't get you anywhere, but you do have to make some choices.
Yeah, you do. And I think that's partly my perspective, in that I'm quite comfortable with people having an appreciation for non-sentient entities, whether that's because they think they have intrinsic moral value, or like me, that they have instrumental value because of our, you know, rich networks of interdependencies, and the fact that it's deeply important for all sentient beings to live in a rich, empowering environment. So that's so I'd share that deep environmental concern, for example, I think, with someone who is more of an ecocentrist or a biocentrist. We have that overlap. Yeah. But to your point, my frustration is when people extend their moral concern much more broadly, and the mainstream environmental movement certainly does this, while still conveniently carving out very obviously sentient animals from their moral consideration. The mainstream environmental movement will go, we care about humans because of the threat that climate change presents to humans. I now have a broader concern for ecosystems and habitats and species diversity and the planet as Gaia, but I will still enjoy my bacon sandwich. And that I find bizarre, because in a way that form of ecocentrism is actually just another form of anthropocentrism. It's really just another way of reflecting human preferences on the world. It's not really a genuine expansion of the moral scope at all. So I find that frustrating. Whereas other people have a broader conception, but as you do, it's still centered around the imperative to have compassion for beings that are capable of suffering. And then you can go broader as well. I don't know if that...
Yeah. And that's an interesting example, because one reaction I have to it is I don't really care so much what people's reasons are.
Yeah.
I mean, that we're converging on a change in behavior, which is good for everybody.
Yeah. Almost whatever the motivation
and
is.
You come to that. And climate disruption is a pretty powerful motivator.
Yeah.
Should be. So if that's the reason that you stop eating animal products, hooray. And I do think that this sense of the interconnectedness of humans with ecosystems and with the global ecosystem is super important.
Yeah.
So again, however that comes about, hooray.
That's
a win.
And one thing that sometimes happens is that I think even if the motivations for someone changing their behavior to become more ethical isn't necessarily because of the ethics, once the behavior change has happened, it can free people to actually update their ethics as well, even though it's a little bit backwards.
Yeah. And I think it's very thought about this too. And it's, I don't understand it. I'm sure psychologists study this in detail, but why people get so back against the wall when you talk about not eating animals for animal ethics reasons. And vegan is a dirty word. It's really off-putting to a lot of people. And when you talk about climate change, it's much less threatening.
Yeah.
To personal belief systems, or maybe if you have been eating animals for 50 years of your life and all of a sudden trying to say, oh God, that was really wrong. What have I done? That's a pretty powerful pill to swallow too. So it may be probably a combination of things, but I find it pretty interesting.
But I'm with you. I think the outcome is what we're interested in from a compassionate perspective. Whichever lever we need to pull, let's pull them all. So, and I guess that's, we've touched on this already, but the final chunk of the conversation is about the future. And I may resist this and you may go back to the sort of straw dog's perspective, but I sometimes try and set an optimistic cast and say, look, if we could get more people to engage more naturalistically with reality and have a broader compassion and a more generous compassion. If we could flick a switch and make that happen, what would that more utopian future look like? How would it feel? But also, how can we push towards it?
I'd like to be more optimistic.
You don't have to be. You can you can reject the premise if you like.
No, I think that I have to. Otherwise, it's too distressing to contemplate. I guess I would love to see us evolve into a world where people have compassion for other living beings. And there are, I think there are places around the globe where you can't exist without interacting with animals in such a way that involves killing them and eating them. But you can do that in a way that is still identifying them as sentient beings. But the way we consume and kill animals in the U.S., just to take that local example, is it's horrific. It's without thought. And people are so disconnected from animals. And if you go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, I don't think people even understand that they're consuming an animal in a weird way. And the anti-scientific attitude that has been encouraged in this country over the last 4 years is really disturbing too. This, because to me, that's a rejection of any possible kind of rational interaction with the world or trying to understand the world and interact with it from a place of understanding rather than ignorance. Going back to, you know, having compassion is one thing, but compassion needs to be grounded
in reality,
and in understanding. So I don't think science is going to save us, but I really hope that people become more scientifically oriented. And I know that begins in childhood. I would like to specifically see children learn about nature, not through capturing tadpoles at the local pond and taking them home and making them pets with death following soon after for the tadpoles, but by going out into nature. And I know a lot of people don't have access to that because of where they live or how they live. So it'd be nice if that changed, to have more green spaces and not just human managed green spaces like Central Park. Central Park's probably wild in a lot of ways, you know, park that's just green manicured grass that pour chemicals on and some squirrels. And I'd like to see, I don't know, we could have a lot of conversations about the domestication of animals and where that has has taken us and where that might lead. And in particular, I've thought a lot about, with Mark Beckhoff, what would happen to other animals like dogs, in particular, if humans disappeared from the planet. And in many ways, they would be much better off. So I think that helps us think about
what's the subject of your book.
That's the subject of our forthcoming book. And that was a really interesting thought experiment, because it was what it really was about, or what are the ways in which we interact with dogs now that are not ideal? What would a dog-friendly future look like, assuming that humans don't disappear? And maybe dogs would like it if we did, but we're probably not going to. So they're going to have to deal with us. It would be different. They wouldn't be pets in the way they are now. Pet keeping, I think, in my ideal future, would go away as a way of living with other animals, because I think it's just bizarre. That's one way to say it, morally bizarre, to lock animals up and for our own entertainment. I'd like to see captivity. I guess that's one way to frame my ideal future world, is animals would no longer by the billions the way they are now and exploited for our own use. In the realm of research, we would have developed non-animal alternatives. There would be no more animal models.
Yeah.
No more animals in labs. No more animals used in testing labs for genetic manipulations, all the things that we do. No more zoos. There might be sanctuaries for animals whose habitats we have completely destroyed, but no more zoos. So I can think of some things that I would like to see happen. So it really would be a different way of interacting with other sentient beings on the planet.
Yeah, it's an inspiring vision. And do you have a view as to what impact, if any, that would have on ethics between humans? Because one of the challenges that some people will put when we talk about non-human sentience is to say, look, we have enough problems with, you know, human ethics and human relations and human discrimination. Shouldn't we focus there first? How do you respond to that challenge when we're thinking about human sentience, not just the non-human sentience?
I don't think that compassion is a limited commodity, where if you use it on animals, you use it up and you don't have any left for people.
Yeah,
that's just a weird way of thinking about things, I think. I think the more compassion you build, the more you have to give. So building empathy for animals will help build empathy for other people. And you could take a really tiny example here of how everybody could benefit. I spend my days thinking about dogs and the ethics of living with dogs. So it's a dog example. Being a good, put that in scare quotes, good dog guardian also overlaps almost, not entirely, but largely with being a good neighbor to other humans in your community.
Yeah.
And if you build goodwill by being a good dog guardian, everybody treats each other better and there's less human conflict. There's a lot of human conflict that relates to dogs, a lot. Really quite sort of brutal interactions because people with dogs don't respect the needs of each other or the needs of people who don't have dogs or don't like dogs and don't want to interact with dogs. And I think you could spread that out more broadly and just say, if we can learn to treat animals better, we'll also learn to treat each other better and vice versa.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It feels like a win-win to me. So
I don't see any downsides and
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, I think we've balanced out the pessimism of a straw dog's future with a vision of a, you know, a more compassionate world. So at least we've painted the picture, much to work for. Yeah. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. What's the best way people could follow you, learn about your work, read your books, and advance order your upcoming book with Mark?
My website is my name, jessicapierce.net. And that you can find information there about all of my books. You can find a link to my Psychology Today blog, which is called, and probably the two best ways to find about my work.
That's great. Thank you. And I'll include links in the show notes so that people can click through and follow you and find what you do.
Yeah. Sorry for the poor internet connection and for the appearance by Bella.
Now, that was a pleasure. It was good to meet her. And like you say, living up in the mountains, it's a beautiful place to be, but internet connectivity is one sacrifice you have to make sometimes.
Yeah. It's a happy sacrifice.
Yeah. But it's been great to be in touch. It's been inspiring to talk to you.
And, it was fun and good luck with getting this whole project.
Thank you. I think you summarized it beautifully. Yeah. Compassion needs to be grounded in reality. I couldn't say it any better. So I may be reusing that with your permission.
You can quote me on that.
Cool. Thank you.
Keep me informed of your doings.
Absolutely. I'll put you on our contact list and I'll keep you posted. And it's great to be in touch. Thank you for all of your work.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?